This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
This week's JodBite is with James McKee. James has just entered his third year as a PhD student in Jodrell Bank's Pulsar Group, where he's involved in the search for gravitational waves. Hi, James.
Hey, Ben.
So, at the risk of being repetitive, we've talked a lot about pulsars in the past on the JodCast, but can you give us a sort of brief overview of what a pulsar is? What do they look like? How do we think they form?
Okay, so a pulsar is the collapsed core of a star that's gone supernova. It's crushed down into a sphere a few kilometres across, but weighing approximately 1.5 times the mass of the Sun. Angular momentum is also conserved as it gets crushed down, so it gets spun up to extremely high velocities. Such a large amount of matter rotating at such a high velocity is very difficult to slow down, so these things rotate with incredible regularity, and as such we can use these as clocks distributed around the galaxy.
So how do we actually see them?
We observe them at radio frequencies, just looking for repeating time series in our observations.
So there's a particular part of this star that actually emits as it spins?
Yes, we have radio beams coming out of the two magnetic poles that, if they're misaligned with the axis of rotation, as they sweep around, it creates like a lighthouse effect. So we can see this blinking on and off with radio telescopes on the Earth.
So roughly how many of these objects do we know of so far?
We know of about 2,500 so far, varying rotational velocities, varying properties.
So what would you say are the slowest and the fastest pulsar?
They range from a period of as long as about 8 seconds to periods of almost 1 millisecond.
Wow, so extremely fast. So pulsars are well renowned as tools for other areas of astrophysics. Could you tell us a little bit about what pulsars have been used for in the past?
Well, something that we like to use them for is to try and detect gravitational waves. So we think that because certain pulsars, millisecond pulsars, spin extremely regularly, they can actually rival atomic clocks in timing accuracy. So by analysing the arrival times and comparing them to the expected arrival times that we should see pulses, we hope to see the evidence of space-time being stretched and compressed by gravitational waves between us and the pulsar.
So why do you think space-time is being stretched in the first place? Where does that idea come from?
Well, this idea comes from general relativity. It was predicted nearly 100 years ago, and there's been efforts for about 30 years to try and discover evidence of this. There's been indirect evidence that such phenomenon exists. We've seen the orbital radius of orbiting pulsars shrinking due to energy being radiated by gravitational waves. So we're very confident that they exist. It's just a very, very precise measurement that we have to make. It's a very small quantity that we're trying to measure.
So you're involved in a collaboration called the European Pulsar Timing Array.
Yeah, that's right.
It's tempting to think of something called a pulsar timing array as an array of telescopes, but that's not what this is it?
No, and this is probably going to get a bit more confusing as the conversation goes on. But the European Pulsar Timing Array refers to a collection of pulsars distributed across the sky that we observe. We try to find a correlated signal between these pulsars. That is a passing gravitational wave affecting all of them as we expect them to, rather than just using one or two sources.
So I guess if you were to just look at a single pulsar and see something that might look like a gravitational wave, you couldn't really be confident that is a gravitational wave. It could just be something either intrinsic to the pulsar or intrinsic to the Earth. So you have to use effectively a set of these things. So when you say that this gravitational wave is passing through, it's not passing through all those pulsars at once. This is the Earth, right?
This is the Earth term that's important. You can set limits using individual pulsars, but to have any sort of confidence to claim a direct detection, you need to see this telltale signature across all of the pulsars in your timing array.
So how many pulsars do you need to be able to detect gravitational waves?
That depends, I suppose. As many as possible would be the best. We use 42 in the European Pulsar Timing Array, and our competitors in Nanograv in North America and the Parkes Pulsar Timing Array in Australia use a similar number.
So pulsars are really, really good clocks, but they're not perfect clocks. There are still noise processes that might get in the way. So what sort of things might stop you from seeing a gravitational wave signature in pulsars?
Well, to begin with, we need to have quite a good idea of fundamental quantities to the pulsar, like its period, its spin-down rate, if it's in a binary, the binary parameters, how far away it is from its companion, the orbital velocity, things like that. Its velocity through the Milky Way. A big source of uncertainty comes from interstellar space itself. It's not empty, it's full of free electrons, form a plasma that affect the arrival times of the pulse, particularly at low frequencies. And this is very difficult to get a handle on. We need to measure at multiple frequencies, compare the data, and over quite a long time period.
When we're doing electromagnetic astronomy, we can look at different bands, we can look at different wave bands, we can look at radio waves, we can look at X-rays, we can look at optical astronomy. Is there a similar distribution or a similar spectrum of wave bands that are expected to come from gravitational wave astronomy? And if so, what is it you're sensitive to with pulsar timing?
Well, we expect there to be a spectrum of gravitational waves that that exists in the universe. We have high-frequency waves that we expect to be generated by anisotropies on neutron star surfaces. We have like a sort of middle range that we expect to see from orbiting massive objects like binary neutron stars, or binary white dwarfs. And then we have the very low frequency regime that we expect to be dominated by a gravitational wave background, like a superposition of all the different sources. Some of these sources that we should be sensitive to are orbiting supermassive black holes, cosmic strings, things from the very early universe. This is what pulsar timing arrays are sensitive to, these very low frequencies. The higher frequencies are being probed by LIGO at the moment and the proposed LISA mission.
So these interferometers, I guess, that are either on the ground or in space that are looking at two different laser beams, and if you see differences in the arrival times of those laser beams, then you potentially detected a gravitational wave.
Yeah, that's true. And in fact, pulsar timing is also interferometry. Just we use interferometers with arm lengths, the scale of the galaxy, rather than the scale of kilometres.
I think this is actually really cool. That, I mean, we actually know so little about pulsars and so little about neutron stars. We don't really know how they emit. We don't really know what they're made of to any great degree of accuracy. Their formation is still a bit of a mystery, and yet we can do all this really quite amazing science with it. You say that we're going to detect gravitational waves from supermassive black holes. It can constrain things like the masses of those black holes. It can tell us about galaxy formation and how galaxies interact. So these are really cool systems that we know nothing about that are telling us so much about everything else.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And when we can start to detect gravitational waves and we get some expertise with it, we can even use these as a way of looking at the universe. So at the moment, we can only use electromagnetic radiation. A little bit of neutrino astronomy, which is in its infancy, but gravitational wave astronomy has not been possible yet, so it still isn't possible. And when it is possible, who knows what that's going to bring up.
Is it a question of when?
I think it is. We've got extremely good evidence that gravitational waves exist. It's just been really difficult to detect them up to this point. We certainly hope that with pulsar timing arrays, we should be able to make a detection within the next 10 years.
Wow.
With LIGO, well, that might even be a little bit sooner.
Do you think there's a bit of a race on between the different frequency bands that people are looking for? LIGO looking for high frequencies, you looking for low frequencies? Or?
I think people in the pulsar timing community like to think there's a race on, but I don't think any of us really expect to win it.
Right. And nobody's going to begrudge anybody that sees it first, right? It's all, everybody wants the science. It doesn't really matter at the end of the day who gets it.
To an extent, but it would still be nicer to be the part of the team that makes the first detection.
Well, let's hope that's part of the collaboration that you're working on, which I'd like to move on to. So as part of the European Pulsar Timing Array, there is this other thing called the Large European Array for Pulsars. So can you tell us a little bit about what that is?
Okay, so the Large European Array for Pulsars isn't an array of pulsars this time. It's an array of telescopes. Telescopes are expensive things to build, and we don't want to sit around waiting for the SKA to finally come online. So we found a way to tie together the five biggest telescopes in Europe. That's the Lovell at Jodrell Bank, Westerbork Synthesis Radio Telescope in the Netherlands, Effelsberg in Germany, the Nansei Radio Telescope in France, and the Sardinia Radio Telescope in Sardinia. So we tie these together and observe a set of millisecond pulsars once a month. This allows us to form a virtual telescope with a 195-meter equivalent, which actually makes it the second largest telescope in the world, for now, until FAST comes online next year.
So are all five telescopes looking at the same pulsar for the same amount of time, or are you all looking at different pulsars and then you correlate your data afterwards?
Yeah, we observe the same pulsars simultaneously throughout the observing sessions. We have to be very careful to make sure that we are observing for a very particular amount of time so we can add the data together properly without any gaps or anything like that.
Is that quite a challenge to add data together from different telescopes?
It certainly has been, and it takes us quite a lot of time each month, but we've started to get quite good at it, and what used to take months a few years ago, we can now do in a few days.
So what will it mean when we discover gravitational waves? And I do want to say when, because it's going to happen eventually. What will it actually mean for astronomy? What will we be able to do? What will we be able to see that we can't see with just electromagnetic radiation?
Well, the handy thing about gravitational waves is that they, or we think, they aren't shielded by anything. Electromagnetic waves are affected by the interstellar medium as they travel through it. They can be affected by the atmosphere, or they can just be affected by solid objects getting in the way. As far as we know, gravitational waves shouldn't be affected like this. So you can probe things like the inner part of the Milky Way that's almost impossible to image because of dust, and at radio wavelengths the large amount of free electrons. You can see things that don't shine, like black holes, and we hope we should be able to see closer to the Big Bang, because for several hundred thousand years after the Big Bang, space was opaque, so there's no way you can use electromagnetic radiation to probe that region of the universe.
So this could get you a window into what was happening before the cosmic microwave background formed.
Absolutely. It should be interesting to astronomy in all fields, not just pulsars, not just theory, but cosmology, galaxy formation, dark matter, dark energy, anything. In breakthroughs in astronomy, there usually ends up being something completely unexpected that comes to the surface, and that can redefine astronomy for years to come. With the advent of the radio telescope, there were a lot of accidental Nobel Prizes. The discovery of pulsars by accident, the cosmic microwave background being detected. With even things in its infancy, like neutrino astronomy, we had the solar neutrino problem that led to the theory of neutrino oscillations. And with measuring the spectra from distant stars, we inadvertently observe that the expansion of the universe is accelerating.
So who knows what's going to come out of this?
Exactly.
So you're not just involved in the Large European Array for Pulsars. You've done a little bit of work on probably the most famous pulsar, the Crab Pulsar. You're currently writing a paper on that, I believe, so hopefully you'll come back and talk to us when that paper's out.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'd like that.
Tell us all about the Crab. In the meantime, the best of luck with your search for gravitational waves, and thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Ben.